Welcome to Start Writing. I'm Joe Bendosky, and this is our first interview in, I guess, over a year. It has been a while. And I guess there's a couple reasons for the changes. Is Jay and I have spent the last probably 6 months talking about exposition and researching it. And something that I kept thinking in my mind is I wondered what other authors would recommend to their fellow writers on this topic. What are some of their experiences? What are some of their examples? What's some of the best advice they've gotten on this topic? And so as I was kind of rolling that idea around in my head, Mark Everglade reached out to me about his upcoming book, and I thought this would be a great opportunity to get multiple writers' opinions and advice on this. So it's not just me and Jay doing some research and then presenting. We'll have more perspectives on it. And I thought that would be really useful to the community. And with that, Mark Everglade, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and your book?
Absolutely. Hi, I'm author Mark Everglade, and I'm the author of Hemispheres, in addition to many short stories that have been published in the slipstream and absurdist genres, which are kind of postmodern deconstructivist genres. And I live in Tallahassee, Florida, and essentially my book Hemispheres is a cyberpunk novel. And in it, Hemispheres is about a tidal-locked planet where half of it is always dark and half is always light. So on the dark side, they use fireflies for both light and currency, with other sources of light being illegal for a variety of reasons that the exposition has to explain. The poor don't have enough to live by in this kind of dystopian planet, so a group of rebels are trying to rotate the planet faster to bring daylight cycles to everyone while the government's trying to stop them. So the poor are really literally and metaphorically kept in the dark by the elites. So this is really, you know, very cyberpunk, very dystopian, you know, in that kind of way.
So what's your opening hook? What's the hook of the book? Like we open the sample page on Amazon. What's going to pull us in?
You're going to see Severin waking up. Severin Rivenshear is basically a mercenary at this point in his life. And he is trying to obtain a letter from a courier. And it's a very urgent mission that's being delivered to him. They can't trust electronic transmission because electronic transmission is so easily hacked that they're actually relying more. And so he's rushing to get this letter. And in the meanwhile, a variety of different events occur as he's rushing out to get this letter, such as a little boy is committing a felony. And he has to choose between, do I help this little boy who's about to be injured while committing this felony, or do I, you know, continue with what I'm doing? And that's a way that you can show character early on, you know, by putting characters into a sense of conflicting situations. And also, I use that to show a little exposition, because he tells the boy after saving him, I had to grow up just as fast. You know, I grew up on the streets just like you. And so it kind of provides a sense of urgency to that exposition. And that's chapter one. Yeah.
Okay. And then we have two other guests. I have Tim Young, or I guess his author name is T.K. Young. Why don't you introduce yourself, some of your background, and then introduce your book as well?
Sure. So my name is Tim Young. I put the TK out there because I guess you have to have a K middle initial to, you know, get famous in the writing world these days. I've written several novels and a number of short stories as well. I've been writing for, you know, as long as I can remember. My novel that I'm talking about today is called Tall Girl Rising. It's a story of a tortured orphan struggling to understand voices in her head and the powers that they give her in a drought-ravaged future. Put yourself in the shoes of a 12-year-old girl about 100 years in the future in India. You know, everyone is starving because global warming is happening and we're running out of water and there's not enough water for food. People around you are starving, but you're never hungry. And you have these voices in your head that tell you how to survive. And they might tell you to stab your neighbor to death one second. They might tell you to save the person who stole your brother's shoes the next. So you don't know what these voices are. You don't know where they're coming from. All you know is you're scared and people are noticing that you're different. Then one day someone comes and murders your brother and starts coming after you. And in the process of your flight across the ravaged India, you realize that you may have the key to fixing this stuff. And if you can stay sane long enough and figure out what these voices are trying to tell you and what exactly you are, maybe you can save everyone. So that's Tall Girl Rising. I really strive to do a cross between Cormac McCarthy's The Road and The Wind-Up Girl by Paolo Bacigalupi, whose last name I hope I'm pronouncing correctly. That's Tall Girl Rising.
All right. Awesome. Thank you. And where can we find your book?
Amazon would be the best place. You can find it out there a lot, but you know, Amazon is the giant.
And then my last guest, and if you've noticed, there's kind of a trend here. These are all sci-fi authors. which kind of fits with our exploration of exposition. We looked at the expanse, particularly just in dealing with either fantasy or sci-fi. You're going to have a lot of world building, which is a lot of exposition. So my last guest, Joseph Hertgen or Hertgren? How would you say that exactly?
Hertgen, but you're pretty close.
All right, go ahead and introduce yourself and your book.
So I've written a couple novels. I'm writing a third one right now. My first two are called Tower Defender and Sherman. I've also written a monograph that explores archival embodiment in science fiction, and I call that The Archive Incarnate. Written a bunch of short stories as well, but my book Sherman is the most recent finished work, and it's really environmentalist sci-fi and political satire. So here's a nice little blurb for you. Environmental collapse and the ruin of war threatens not just our future, but our lives right now. Can a time-traveling William Tecumseh Sherman change America's downward trajectory? So the beginning of this novel actually shows you a kind of rewriting of history, because you have this group of Native Americans who call themselves the Seminoles, who want Turtle Island back. And so they've discovered how to time travel, and they're going back to key moments in American history, and they're taking charge. They're taking command. So the very first scene, you actually have these Native Americans hijacking the planes that blew up the World Trade Centers. And right before impact, they time travel, parachutes on, and then they slowly descend down to a Arcadian vision of Manhattan Island. No skyscrapers, nothing. They've gone back hundreds of years in the past to a time when Native Americans lived and controlled this whole country. And so they're coming back down to this green, beautiful expanse, unpeopled.
All right. And then where can we find your books? What's the easiest way to track them down?
Amazon's a great place. If you live in Louisville, you can go to Carmichael's. They're an amazing bookseller, a local bookseller. I love those guys. Even if you don't live in Louisville, just you can order online from them.
So we're going to kind of get into it. And so what's going to happen is I've asked each of these authors to kind of make selections from their books about different types of exposition and to pick out which ones they really wanted to focus on. So that's what we'll kind of do throughout the rest of the interview. We'll talk to each author about a type of exposition they've picked that they either feel they've done really well or they're very comfortable with, or they have a lot in their book. And they'll illustrate some examples from their books, which I think will be good. You'll get some exposure to some of their writing, and you'll get someone other than me and Jay's perspective on this, which I think will be very good. So Mark mentioned that he was very comfortable about talking about exposition in dialogue. So go ahead and give us your ideas, your best advice, and some great examples from your book.
Sure, absolutely. So exposition and dialogue allows you to make the exposition seamless, because it shouldn't be obvious to the reader that you're making an exposition. It should be just part of the world that they're naturally exposed through a sort of osmosis. And so in Hemispheres, I had to explain solar tidal locking, which is different than the moon's tidal locking to the Earth. And it's very difficult to do this without making a discourse on physics. And, you know, I never paid attention in physics class anyway, so I'm not the person to really do that. So I figured, how can I make a discourse in physics that people would actually be interested in? And I basically just shortened it up into what's the basic things they need to know and put it in dialogue. So here's the example. Shadir searches through an icy fog, like a sheet of blurry diamond crystals, into the cave's entrance is clear. These rebels will never be one of us. They abandon our ways, and now they abandon their lives, shamed in caves, outcast by choice. Yeah, but do you ever think, his companion says, of what it would actually be like to have seasons, to have seasons and sunlight? I'm not saying I'm a sympathizer with these rotationists, but it would be odd. The entire sky would blink day and night cycles. Still, I'd rather be on a frozen hemisphere than burning up on the dayburn side of the planet where it's always light. Now, I don't know about you, but when it's all over, I'm going to spend the fireflies I earn on a ticket, and I'll see the sun for my own self. And so in this example, you know, you get the idea that half the planet is dark and half is light, without going into, you know, the physics of why this is, or tidal bulging, or any of those things that the reader wouldn't be as interested in. Now, it can almost seem forced when you do this, I think, if it's not, you know, you don't want the exposition to be so transparent that it seems like you're forcing it out, which in this case, I almost do, I think.
I enjoyed the slang, the Dayburn side, what they called it there. I thought that was a good choice of words there.
Yeah, yeah. They're not going to call it the bright side of the planet. That's not very creative.
Now, Joseph or Tim, did either of you have an example from dialogue? Mark had mentioned specifically that he was prepared for this. I think Tim said he's kind of ready for anything. Do you have an example of dialogue and exposition? And again, any best advice you've been given on this throughout your career as well?
Yeah, I can start there. And you know, one of the things that I always like to do, take an antagonist, right? What do you know about an antagonist? And they have a reason for what they're doing, just like the protagonist does. And in their own mind, they're thinking they're doing the right thing. And I've got a scene, I think it's it opens up my third chapter, where the antagonist and his boss, who he's really trying to overthrow, are kind of getting into things a little bit. And they're basically in the back and forth, you're seeing the control, you know, who has the control, you know, versus who's the face of the operation, so to speak. You have a lot of back and forth about some of the technical underpinnings of what's left of the society. I'm not going to read that too much, but, you know, basically what I was trying to do is show who has the real power in this situation by showing what they control and getting the technical details out of the way through that. So I'll save my reading for a different question down the road, though.
All right. Sounds good. Joseph, did you have a dialogue example for us? I know you had mentioned specifically flashbacks where you were, you know, really prepared, but I just wanted to check if you had a good example or maybe just a good piece of advice somebody's given you down the road on this topic.
Yeah. You know, one thing I read recently was that it's a good idea when you're writing to start your book, you know, close to the end so that you're not just kind of going around in circles and giving the reader stuff that isn't going to interest them. And I've been reading a book by Kazuo Ishiguro, Never Let Me Go. And this guy, he kind of masters that whole idea of not starting too far away from the end, because he actually starts the beginning of a person's life, but through dialogue slowly lets you know what in the world is going on in this beautiful book, Never Let Me Go. About one third of the way through, one of the characters, one of the guardian women, finally spills the beans on what in the world is going on with these kids? What's going on in this world? And you learn that, you know, at some point, these kids are going to have to give up parts of their bodies, maybe a liver, maybe a kidney, maybe a hand, who knows, right? But for 80 pages, you have no idea. And you don't learn because the narrator tells you. You learn because one of the guardians feels so terrible that this connection that she's formed with these kids includes lying, right? Concealing the truth. And so she comes out and tells them what their future is. And it's heart-wrenching. I want to finish reading this book, but I feel like I need, you know, like a campfire and some like happy songs first before I dive back in, because it is really killing me. And the dialogue is just like taking my heart and just like wrenching it.
What is the book again? Give me the title one more time. Never Let Me Go.
Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. It was 2005 publication. He also wrote The Remains of the Day, and this was actually a winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature. So This is good stuff.
Yeah, I'll definitely look up at least the first little bit. I want to kind of see how that dialogue's going. You got my interest there. All right, so you had mentioned very specifically that flashbacks, you've been working on one all week. It's some an area you're very comfortable about talking about. How do we leverage the flashback to get in some good pieces of backstory and exposition?
Thank you. That's a great question. And my answer might at first sound stupidly simple, but just hang with me because I'm gonna go past the stupidly simple. But first, if I'm thinking about flashbacks, I like to break down the word into its component parts, flash and back. So what these two words gestured toward is that flashback moments shouldn't last long. It's a flash. And of course, it's a moment of thinking about something occurring in the past or back in time. So characters might have a brief memory of something that happened to them or something they witnessed. They might remember something that was said. Most importantly, though, a flashback is always triggered by some current event, and it reveals something about the character. Plus, it usually drives the plot forward. Now, a flashback works best when the remembered moment constitutes a brief but impactful event. In terms of space, one good-sized paragraph, that's really all you need. To give a flashback the feeling of verisimilitude, I try to work in human memory's tendency toward the image instant, which is that or those moments in time that we connect to powerful psychological and emotional events in our lives. So you can get a feel for the connection between the image and its emotive and psychological power by cueing yourself with the names of good friends, maybe family member, a various totem of personal import. You can even try it. Just think about, like, you know, dad or mom or whatever, and see what, like, see what comes up. What image do you see when you evoke those names or those things? What mindset or feeling does it carry? Our identities are established by experience reinforced over time. Some of those experiences, the ones that make us feel too much, we actively bury. And others we treasure and we try to return to as often as we can. They're our favored constructions of the self. They provide us with stability, just as buried, painful memories provide a threat to stability. But the events of the present have a way of resonating with our past, both the good and the bad, and we're always ever one experience away from that surfeit of memory. Now, in the fiction I've written, I'm kind of focusing on the bad. So I'm going to give you one from the current novel I'm working on. It's called Taekwondo. And so I'll give you the lead up to the flashback because, as I said...
Yeah, we're going to need some context.
Yeah, the event occurs to cause the flashback, and that's super important. Okay, so here we go. They were silent for a while. Too long. I saw something move in my peripheral. I turned and saw the barrel-chested man taking sight, his gun resting on a mailbox. I rolled out of his vision behind a tree. A shot rang out, kicking up dust close by. I dove for cover through a shrub row and got scratched up on my arms. Should have phoned in a robo-Ronald the second I saw him. Where are you going to go now, boy? Going to run back to your mammy? I wish that. Most days I wish that. I could picture her freckled face, running a hand through my coarse hair the color of coal. Her parents were both Irish. She looked a lot like Lake, really, and Dad was German-English. But I had skin the color of chestnuts. Dad thought Mom cheated on him. Grasped that belief like a burning coal. The night of my 16th birthday, he threw her against a wall and then lashed at her with his belt. Lashed and lashed. I couldn't do anything to help. Just watched from behind the edge of my door as he beat her while she screamed, "He's your son!" over and over. I fell asleep somehow, the cries of pain ringing in my ears, and I never saw her again. Maybe he killed her. Maybe she slipped out and ran far away.
Awesome. Thank you. So I guess one of the things that I really stood out to hear that I hadn't considered is you mentioned the image of the flashback, right? Because it's a flashback, we get some strong images. And this can kind of become a powerful psychological symbol for the character that to invoke a second time, all we need is the single image, the knife, the freckles, the belt, whatever. And I think this then becomes a really powerful tool to back reference this as needed for future character dilemmas, because like I said, through the flashback, we've created this symbol psychology connection for an individual character that we can then carry through the story. I thought that was a really great point.
Yeah. One thing I saw recently was William Gibson talking about Neuromancer and how he wanted to carry some image throughout the book. So he uses shuriken stars, you know, like the ninja throwing stars. And early in the book, he sees some through a window and he says something like, those were my guiding stars. And then at the end of the book, and he buys one of the stars, by the way, and he puts it in his pocket. And then a couple hundred pages go by before the end of the book where he picks the stars up out of his pocket and he uses it to break something, you know, this critical important piece in the book. So yeah, you can use an image to help you flashback in narrative as well to an important earlier part, like you're mentioning, with you know, you could use the belt or whatever you wanted, the freckle.
So awesome. All right. So I'm going to ask Tim and Mark both on this. Now, I know Mark had said that he didn't really have anything. So if you don't have a comment, I will just edit this part out of the podcast. That's the beauty of editing. So Mark, did you have anything to bring up on flashbacks, or maybe just a really good piece of advice you've gotten about writing them?
Absolutely. So, you know, flashbacks. So here with flashbacks, I've always known that they were supposed to be triggered by a current event, like Dr. Hirschens said. However, I have never thought about using them to drive the plot forward. I think that's where this is something I just learned here, and I think that's something that's hard to use. It's something you don't think about when, you know, the past driving the plot forward, being able to connect that sort of use the flashback to describe an exposition of interiority, as they say in literary theory, to drive, and then connecting that to the plot going forward. I think that is really difficult to do personally.
So, all right, awesome. And then Tim, do you have any short examples or good piece of advice on the flashback to add in here?
Yeah, I mean, I think so my book actually starts with a flashback, but I think Dr. Hirschens, what you said about keeping them brief, I think is key, because if you think about, you know, you as a writer, especially with science fiction, you've got so much information to unload, and the world is so different. You can't say he went outside and got in the car, because the car might fly. You might have, you know, taken a jetpack to go outside, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so you have to, you know, put this density of information right up front. And the challenge is really, does the reader need to know this now? And why does the reader need to know this now? So I'll read just the first five sentences of my book and kind of give you a sense of why I chose flashback for a sentence, a different type of exposition. So once on his orphanage's flickering tablet, Lucas had found images of India's jade jungles, women wrapped in glowing saffron, the cobalt veins of rivers that coursed with the murmurs of the gods. Now, as his shuttle roared toward yet another city's erasure, that riot of vanished color haunted his mind. He wondered if it would make the relocations easier if he carried no memories, felt nothing for those he'd leave to die. There wasn't enough water to produce enough food. There wasn't enough fuel to desalinate more water. And when the energy ministry identified a city that could no longer be sustained by the hegemony's dwindling resources, it sent Lucas and his fellow control officers to staunch the bleeding. So those are five sentences, and the first one is a flashback. He's thinking back to when he was an orphan. He is basically, the reason I have that there is I want the reader to feel the character's loss, because this is a character that's almost gone numb. They're just doing what they have to do to survive, and they're well aware of all the atrocities that they're committing, but they've made a decision that, you know, they're going to kind of go numb inside. Now, in the areas where you don't see exposition yet, there's a guy named Lucas living in India, which is obviously not a the kind of name you would expect there. So, you know, how did this orphan get over here? We don't know yet. We don't need to know yet, but we'll get there. We have an energy ministry. We don't know what that is. We don't know what the hegemony is, but we're not going to stop yet. We're going to draw you in and get you there. Thinking about, does the reader need to know this now, and how you kind of set up that exposition, those two lines, there wasn't enough water to produce enough food. There wasn't enough fuel to desalinate more water. I had my original chapter was 30 some pages long, and Lucas was walking through a camp to get to the last functioning power plant in the city. And he was having conversations with people along the way that were kind of laying out exactly what the dilemma was. But it's 30 pages before you have your inciting incident, and you don't have that kind of patience in a reader anymore. So eventually what I did was I just had to go to direct exposition and just get it out of the way and, mm-hmm. you know, accept it as a matter of fact kind of thing, which I think helps the character's viewpoint a little bit. So that's why you have those two sentences in there. Just a last note from me on the point of view of the novel itself. Given the density of what I was trying to convey, I mean, this is another culture that a lot of Americans aren't familiar with. It's in the future. You have all kinds of, you know, bioengineering going on, and you need to know how this society is functioning, all of that. I chose to do kind of a limited third person in each of my chapters because I had to pull out and give some of that authorial exposition at the same time, in little stabs here and there, because otherwise it just wouldn't work. I started off trying to do first person, but it just was not a natural way to convey the world that was happening. So I felt like that worked in this situation. And again, you can see some of those examples.
I kind of want to also add that an important aspect of the flashback is that humanity is really defined by memory. And even if we think about human civilization, you think about the recording of history, right? The recording of memory. It's at the time where we actually begin to write things down, the human civilization flowers. Mm-hmm. So, that means like our memories are these very active, powerful things that are creative and even create civilization.
Yeah. And if you don't, you know, a human being is not walking around, you know, thinking about exposition, right? Your experiences are constantly referring back to other things, and you're constantly in the moment, but also thinking about what you want to do next and what you did yesterday. And I think that's the key to good writing, is making that experience as natural as possible on the page, because it's really hard to capture in a written form.
I guess we probably have time for maybe one more. So you did mention briefly direct exposition. So talk to me about the choice to include direct exposition, because I know that's always a hard choice to make as a writer. It's like, I know dialogue is a little smoother and subtler, but I mean, I think at all of us at some point we'd be like, you know, I need the direct here. So talk to me about that choice, and then I will go to Joseph and Mark on this as well.
So that's one for me, Tim. Sure. So I have, this is a future where, they're running out of power. And so what they've done is they've turned people into some biological computers, so to speak. Because there's no way to generate electricity. But you as a person can, kind of work through some of that. And that's it's a concept you can show pretty well, but at the same time, there's a lot of, societal impact of that, right? And so I was running into a situation where it's not the core to the beginning of the book, but you need to understand some things. Otherwise, the narrative is going to fall apart and the reader's just going to be sitting there saying, okay, what exactly is going on?
Right.
So I basically had to just kind of suck it up and decide, all right, this sentence needs to go here. This sentence needs to go there. And I have a paragraph where it's kind of the character's reflection, but it's a really, in my opinion, it's direct exposition. The line goes, implantation was a cruel fate to choose, but agreeing to meld your mind with the hegemony's computer systems was one of the only ways to guarantee your place in the relocation lotteries. So I don't think that, really a character in that situation would be thinking of what's going on, because they're just, this is his pilot that's flying him to the city that he's closing down. But I kind of needed to throw it in there to make sure that people understood what was, you know, what this strange person next to him was. And to Dr. Hurtgen's point, I kept it to a sentence because you can't do much more than that without sounding like you're lecturing and losing people's attention. So it's just kind of one of those things where I think sometimes you just have to be direct and get it over with, and your readers will kind of understand because they do know that they're reading a story.
Okay, so let's go to Mark then. Why don't you give us your feedback there?
Sure. So when I use direct exposition, I try to place it within the context of a character and what's going on. For instance, in one situation, a character is very nervous and she's reciting history. It's one of her obsessions that she does. She counts words in fours, sort of like an OCD thing, and she's reciting history in her mind to calm herself down because that's what calms her down. In another situation, a character is about to provide a lecture to a large group of people, and she's preparing for the lecture by reviewing the history of essentially the planet and everything that she's going to talk about in the lecture, which puts that exposition in within the character's context. In a final example, a governor is providing Severum, the main character, a mission briefing. And this mission briefing contains some of the history of the organization, this rebel group that they're going up against. And so it's providing that, even though it's very direct exposition, providing that within a context of a mission briefing adds a sense of urgency to the exposition. And that's what you're really looking for, is whatever you can do to make the reader hang on to it so they don't feel like they're being info dumped. You know, using and being able to use exposition as ammunition, as you've said, Joseph, on past episodes.
So let's go to Joseph Hurtgen and get his opinion on direct exposition.
So exposition is a chance to tell the reader, what world are you in? To give the reader that kind of view of a character that a character can't give you himself. You know, if you think about yourself, right, and you look in the mirror lies. The mirror never does the thing that a different set of eyes does, right? Like, you will never see yourself the way that other people see you. So here's just a paragraph of exposition from Sherman. Atepa took Sherman's picture. Even though the camera was digital, the lighting was up to professional standards, and her office was informed by a Bauhaus aesthetic, a Spartan and orthogonal arrangement of steel, glass, and hard woods. Sherman's picture still came out looking like something from the Civil War era. The severe cut of his jacket, the high collar, the grizzly beard. These elements practically screamed 1863. But the way he held himself, as if the next bombardment was only minutes off, affixed Sherman eternally to his time, even though he was stranded far apace from the battlefields of the American Civil War. So here we have a kind of vision of what this guy is, a vision that he's not going to be able to tell you through his own dialogue. So it's important as the writer to give your reader this vision of what do these characters really look like? You know, in this world, what is it like to see them right there in front of you?
All right, I want to thank everyone for their time and their participation in our conversation here. Again, this was Mark Everglade in his book Hemispheres, which should be available in July. And then we had T.K. Young talking about his book Child Girl, and then we had Joseph Hurtgen talking about his book, Sherman. As always, we want to thank you for listening. If you're interested in supporting the podcast, you can always check out a book by myself or Jay Washburn, or you can check out one of the books by these guys. If you go to our website and look up this episode, you will see their books, and we'll have links to their materials on Amazon. And buying the books through those links will help support the show as well. And I hope they've brought some different and new perspectives to exposition that maybe Jay and I have missed out in just our own narrow views of the world. We'll have one more interview next month, as I've already recorded the interview, there's some really good points of exposition that come out. And this was an author, he'd been writing his first book, Michael Abramson's, and he had really struggled with the concept of exposition and did not realize just how difficult it would be to tackle, how important it was to convey that in a way that didn't really drive readers away or bore them. And he had a multitude of beta readers and friends kind of talk to him just about their own ideas. And so, like I said, I think it's a really good conversation and some good things that Jay and I didn't cover in our own dive into exposition. And after that interview, we will be back to doing some craft episodes for you as well. So as always, thanks for listening. This is the end of the episode, so it's time to start writing.